Today's scripture is found in 1 Samuel, portions of chapter 27, 28, and 29. Chapter 27. Then David said in his heart, "Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand." So David arose and went over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail. And when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. Then David said to Achish, "If I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be given me in one of the country towns, that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you?" So that day Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. Now David and his men went up and made raids against the Jeshurites and the Girzites and the Amalekites. For these were the inhabitants of the land from of old as far as Shur to the land of Egypt. When Achish asked, "Where have you made a raid today?" David would say, "Against the Negeb of Judah, or against the Negeb of the Jerahmeelites, or against the Negeb of the Kenites." And David would leave neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, thinking, lest they should tell about us and say, "So David has done." Such was his custom all the while he lived in the country of the Philistines. And Achish trusted David, thinking, "He has made himself an utter stench to his people, Israel. Therefore, he shall always be my servant." Chapter 28. In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, "Understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army." And David said to Achish, "Very well, you shall know what your servant can do." And Achish said to David, "Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life." Chapter 29. The Philistines gathered all their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped by the spring in Jezreel. As the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years? And since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day." But the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Send the man back, that he may return to the place to which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his lord?" Then Achish called David and said to him, "The lords do not approve of you. So go back now and go peaceably, that you may not displeased the lords of the Philistines." And David said to Achish, "But what have I done?" And Achish answered, "I know that you are as blameless in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, 'He shall not go up with us to the battle.'" So David set out with his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. But the Philistines went up to Jezreel. You may be seated.
All right, good morning, everybody. Oh, yeah, and kids, head out with Fuzzy over to Children's Church in the courtyard. Yeah, okay, so an interesting passage of Scripture. We kind of condensed three chapters. Actually, we're going to circle back around to the rest of chapter 28 next week. But just the way the story is arranged, it seemed a little bit easier for me to preach it this way. So, yeah. Before we get there, though, if you're an Eagles fan here, you may remember last year, the end of the season, we were faced, at least I was faced, with a great moral crisis. It was the last game of the season. They were playing the Redskins. My heart, my gut, of course, was rooting for my team, the Eagles. But I found my head actually pulling for the Redskins. I've never had that experience before where I've actually been rooting for the Redskins, especially when they were playing against my own team. But I found my head rooting for the Redskins, partly because this was the last game of the season. The Eagles had already missed out on the playoffs. Their season was about done. It was going to be done in a couple hours. And I was half hoping, okay, well, if they lose this game, we're going to get a higher draft pick next year. We might get better selection, you know, get more of the cream of the crop. So that was one thing, but also for me, actually probably the bigger issue was that if the Eagles won that game, or if the Eagles had won that game, and the Cowboys had won their game, the Cowboys were going to go to the playoffs. All the Eagles had to do was just kind of roll over, and then the Cowboys were actually going to miss out on the playoffs, and the Redskins were going to go to the playoffs. And so the Redskins, you know, I don't have too much love in my heart for the Redskins. I definitely have no love in my heart for the Cowboys. Apologies to any Cowboys fans. And so it was hard enough to know we were going into the postseason with no Eagle games, but it was going to be even harder for me to stomach any Dallas Cowboys games. And so my head was saying, okay, come on, Redskins, just keep pulling it out. Let's get the Eagles score or whatever, but Redskins, if you can just pull it out, that'd be great. Or in other words, my head was saying, look, an enemy of my enemy is my friend in this instance. I remember texting that to a friend of mine who is a Redskin fan. I said, I'm in a real moral crisis here. I'm just going to ride with it. An enemy of my enemy is ultimately my friend here. And, you know, this is sort of what we have going on in the passage here, where David, if you're new with us this morning, we're following the story of David as he's on the run, hiding out in the wilderness. David is God's future king over his people. The problem is the old king is not ready for that transition, not letting go, and so he's hunting David down, trying to eliminate him as a threat. And so David's on the run, he's always out in the wilderness, and this time David says, okay, maybe an enemy of my enemy is actually my friend, and so I'm going to go take up residence with the Philistines, who are Israel's perpetual nagging enemy all throughout the book of 1 Samuel, and maybe Saul will relent from pursuing me. Okay, but and here's the thing, right? We've seen David in the wilderness. He's kind of crafty. He's inventive. He comes up with creative ways to survive and to avoid Saul, you know, this way and that. And so we might be inclined to think, okay, David, this is a little bit risky, but, you know, I know you like, you're creative and you come up with strange ways to survive, and maybe you're just deciding to give this a try. Go back down to the Philistines, because he's done this before, mind you. Remember that? And that would be all fine and well, except that in the very beginning, we're given sort of the omniscient voice of the narrator, who actually tells us what's going on in David's heart and mind as he makes this decision to go down into the Philistines. David says in his heart, "Now I shall one day perish by the hand of Saul. So there is nothing better for me than I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand." Anybody else? Does this strike anybody else? It's a little bit odd. Right? I mean, all throughout the wilderness, time and time again, we've seen God bring to David, you know, voices who have told him the exact opposite. Jonathan, come to him and said, "David, be of good cheer, for you will not fall into the hand of my father, King Saul." Or Abigail, who comes and, you know, admonishes him and encourages him and says, "David, if men rise up and seek out your life, you will be bound up in the bundle of the living in the care of your God, and he will fling out as of out of the hollow of a sling all of your enemies before you." I mean, even last week, you know, David, we saw David saying when he had opportunity to kill Saul, and his men around him were urging him to do it. David himself was saying, "Look, guys, that's not for us, and as the Lord lives, he will deal with Saul." I mean, goodness, even at the end of last week's chapter, Saul himself was blessing David. Even Saul himself was, "David, I see that you are destined for great things, none of which will fail." Even Saul was recognizing that at the end of the day, try as he might, he was not going to get a hold of David. And yet here we have David, seems to be wavering in his confidence in the Lord. seems to be waving, saying, I shall die by the hand of Saul. Seems to be wavering in the goodness of the Lord, saying, surely there is nothing better for me than to go down to the land of the Philistines. Which, by the way, is this another significant line, because you remember last week where David is, he's railing against Saul and his men, because look, you guys have driven me from the land of the living God, told me to go essentially into foreign lands and just essentially worship other gods. And David is bemoaning that. And here he's saying, look, basically there's nothing left for me but this. So I could be wrong, but I'm sort of reading this morning as this is David who's wavering in his confidence in God's promises. He's wavering in his confidence in God's goodness to him. Or maybe this is David who's just weary of months, perhaps years now, of always being on the run, always having to look over his shoulder for, you know, in case his pursuers are coming after him. Or David weary after spending night after night sleeping on rocks in caves or barren places in the wilderness. And in his weariness, he throws in the towel, taps out, and says, I'm just going to go down to the Philistines. I don't know. But I do know this. We know David is far from perfect, right? We've seen that already. He's human just like the rest of us. And he's got things going on in his heart and life that come out. And goodness, what one of us has not experienced something of that tension, maybe in a prolonged season of hardship or discomfort or uncertainty, and we have these moments where we waver in our confidence in God's promises. Or we have these moments where we waver in our confidence in God's goodness or his intentions or that he's even here or around or what. And that may or may not lead us into sketchy alternative actions and plans. So on the one hand, we come into this passage a little bit disappointed, if you will, in David. Would have loved to have seen how this would have played out in the wilderness. But on the other hand, there are some incredible things happening in this passage. In spite of David's wavering and his sketchy decision-making here, and it's those incredible things that are happening that deliver a really powerful message for David, and I think also for us as people who are, like David, not yet completed projects, far from perfect, and sometimes wavering, sometimes weak in our confidence. Okay, so that's what we're going to look at this morning, is basically one main thing I want you to see from the passage. So let's talk it through. David again, okay, he's heading to the Philistines, and for some reason he heads back to Gath, heads back to Achish, which is perpetually surprising to me, right? If I would go anywhere else of the Philistine territory, but I wouldn't head to Gath, right? Because you remember, Gath is the hometown of who? Goliath, right? The guy that David made quick work of way back in the Valley of Elah and went around carrying his head and his shield and his sword on his back. And you know, Gath is the place where, you know, at the end of that battle, when the Israelites then went charging after the Philistines and, you know, and overcoming them, they were pursued them all the way to Gath. And so I imagine the people of Gath, I don't know, I would think they would be less than thrilled with this guy David. Achish, for some reason, either he's the most easily duped individual in the Old Testament, or maybe, I don't know, he made some secret deal with David. Look, if you ever want to just you know, come onto my side, I'll happily take you. I don't know what it is, but he descends, he goes to Gath, he goes to Achish. Achish gives him, whatever, safe cover there, refuge. And then David says to him, hey, look, far be it from us to dwell out in your, you know, royal city, so can you give us some other place where we can, me and my 600 men, maybe our wives, our families, can kind of just camp out. And Achish says, yeah, sure, go take Ziklag. Okay. And here's where this starts to get really interesting, really good. And but in order to see that, we have to actually put pause on the passage, and we have to zoom back out and do a quick deep dive into the broader biblical storyline. All right? So hold on, hang in with me here. We actually have to go back to all the way to the very beginning of the biblical storyline. And okay, we want to remember that what is the Bible? But among other things, the Bible is the unfolding story of God coming after his creation, right? God creates this wonderful home, teeming with life, teeming with beauty, teeming with goodness. He puts his image then in it. He puts into this creation his representative rulers, Adam and Eve, right? And he tells them to be stewards of this great creation, to work it, to keep it, to guard it. And also, as the representative rulers, they're also meant to defend it, such that when God's enemies come, you know, they're supposed to guard the goodness and the sanctity of this creation. Of course, we know Adam and Eve fail miserably at this. God's enemy invades this creation, and instead of stomping the head of the snake, crushing it underfoot, instead, Adam and Eve, they listen to the voice of the snake. And they align themselves with the voice of the snake. And just like that, God's enemies now have a foothold in this creation. And from that foothold, now they begin pulling at the threads, and this creation starts to devolve into darkness and brokenness and violence and death. And so then really, from then on, the story is God coming to reclaim this broken and lost creation. Right? And, okay, that story, let's move forward a little bit. That story picks up a whole lot of steam when we get to chapter 12 in that first book in Genesis, where God comes to this guy, Abraham, and he says, okay, Abraham, come with me now. I'm calling you out of whatever you were doing before, and I want you to follow me. And here's the thing. I'm going to make three promises to you, Abraham. First, I'm going to make you fruitful and multiplied. I'm going to give you this great family. And I'm going to give you a land for your family to settle in, to work, and to keep, and to guard for my sake. And through you, here's the third promise, all the families of the earth will one day be blessed. All right, in other words, I'm going to make you into a great family, I'm going to give you a land, and I'm going to use you to go after, back after all the families of the earth. And through you, I'm going to bless all the families of the earth. The other thing he says to Abraham, though, but hey, Abraham, not just yet. The time's not right. He says, a day's coming where the inhabitants of this land that I'm going to give you are going to excel in wickedness. And it's going to get so bad that I'm going to need to come, and I'm going to need to deal with it. I'm going to need to judge them. And when I do, then I will give the land to your people. So sure enough, you fast forward 400, 500 years. And sure enough, the wickedness in the land, the people in the land, gets exceedingly great. All sorts of detestable practices, violence, social oppression, child sacrifice, forced prostitution, right? Just horrible things, such that God decides, okay, now's the time. He's going to come and he's going to judge. And as part of that judgment, raises up Abraham's family, delivers them out of Egypt, carries them through the wilderness, says, okay, guys, now's the time. I'm going to give you this land of promise. And as part of this, here's the deal. You're going to drive out the wicked inhabitants. You're going to drive them out as part of my judgment upon them. You're going to drive them out because I'm going to work this new operation now through you. And I know you. You can't be commingling with this wickedness. Otherwise, you'll just kind of jump right in with it. So you're going to drive them out. So you get into the book of Joshua. That's what happens. They go over and they start conquering the land. They start working it. They start driving the people out. But the Israelites, I don't know, they're kind of like me. I think I've told you before, Amy gets nervous anytime she sees me start a new project around the house or in the yard. Because I have this, at least in her mind, I have this tendency to start project, get them to maybe 75% completion, and then just lose steam. And so there's all these unfinished projects, hence the 10% left of the mulch pile still back there. How many weeks later? I'm getting to it, trust me, I'm trying. So Israelites are the same way. They get into the land, they start driving out the inhabitants, they start taking possession as the land as God's given to them, but then they sort of lose steam, or I don't know what, or they get too comfortable, or they get too lazy, and they just sort of stop, and some of the land isn't taken, some of the inhabitants aren't driven out. One portion of land in particular, Ziklag. Ziklag was promised to Judah, the tribe of Judah. But for whatever reason, Israel, Judah never possessed it, never drove out the inhabitants. So it's kind of significant here that Achish says, yeah, David, go take Ziklag. And then we get that little footnote in there, and to this day, now Ziklag belongs to all the kings in Judah. Some other places. Sorry, I'm blanking on how you pronounce their name. That's why I'm going back and I'm looking at it. Jeshurites, the land of the Jeshurites. You go back into Joshua, it's either 13 or chapter 16. I forget which one goes which. You go back into chapter 13, I think, and you'll find out that the Jeshurites were, the land of the Jeshurites were supposed to be given to, I believe, the leftovers of Manasseh, or the tribe of Manasseh. And for whatever reason, they go and they take their land, but they stop short of conquering the land of the Jeshurites and casting them out. The Gerzites are another one. They were the inhabitants of Gezer and were promised to the tribe of Ephraim. And the tribe of Ephraim goes in, they conquer to a certain point, and then they sort of stop and give up or whatever. And so the inhabitants of Gezer, the Gerzites, are allowed to remain. Or the Amalekites, who we know on multiple occasions, God has said, get these people out of the land. And Saul fails and whatnot. In other words, here's the point. Do you see what's happening here? The old boundaries that were promised to Abraham, promised to the Israelites, but never really conquered, never really taken, are starting to be given to David. While he's in his time of wavering and weakness, in time of wavering and weakness in the Philistine territory. Or another thing, or what is happening here, that God's kingdom operation of building his kingdom, establishing his people, using them one day to reclaim his creation, all the families of the earth, it's making really significant strides here. In that these people are being driven out, this land that has been promised is being taken, the kingdom is being built and established. Again, while David is weak and wavering in Philistine territory. One other really significant thing, huge thing that happens in this passage, comes at the end, actually comes in the beginning of verse of chapter 28 and then chapter 29, where Achish says, all right, come on, David, you, me, the other five lords of the Philistines and thousands of our troops, we're going up and we're making all-out war on Israel. And David says, sure, boss, whatever you say. Let's go. You're going to see what I can do. And I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's David saying, yeah, sure, I'm with you, boss, wherever you're going to want to go. Or if that's David being somewhat cryptic and saying, okay, yeah, sure, let's go, and you'll see what I can do when I turn on you. I don't know. I don't know what David's thinking here. All I know is this creates a huge problem. I mean, think about this. If David aligns himself with the Philistines and they start going into battle in, you know, these various towns and villages and city in Israel, and these people see the Philistines coming in and ransacking their towns and maybe some people being put to the sword, and they see David and their men right alongside with them, well, good luck ever having the respect of those people when you try to be king. Or even worse than that, if David is in any way complicit in Philistine war against Saul, and if Saul would happen to die at the hands of this battle and David is in any way complicit in it, then do you see how he is guilty of the very sins that he keeps telling his people? Hey, look, no, we do not lay a hand on God's anointed. That's for God to deal with. So it's quite the danger here where it's either David losing respect as a king, it's David being guilty of bloodshed, or maybe it's David just putting himself in a really risky behavior, because if he would decide to turn in the midst of battle, that could not go so well for him. David and his 600 men matched up with thousands of the Philistines, not to mention perhaps Saul's own army that's out there still out to get him. So all these, you see how this is a serious predicament. And so what happens? Well, thankfully, the rest of the Philistine lords are not as blind, are not as dumb, are not as duped as Achish was. If it's God who blinds the mind and the eyes of Achish, he leaves the mind and the eyes of the rest of the Philistine lords open, and they come and they say, hey, Achish, who are these Hebrews? Who is this David behind you? And he says, well, yeah, it's David. He's been with me now for a bunch of months and years, and hey, he's done me well. He's good. No fault in him. And he said, yeah, no, I don't think so. We're not taking him into battle. Slight chance that he might turn on us. Send him home. So he goes to David, says, David, the other lords, they don't want you coming, so go home. I find no fault in you, but you got to go home. And David says, what have I done? He says, again, look, David, to me you're as innocent as an angel of Yahweh. But the other guys, they don't want you, so you got to go home. Right? It's actually the only time in this passage where Yahweh's, where God's name is mentioned off the lips of Achish. Okay, but do you see how in this, just this, in this one story, the hand of God is all over it, right? But here's David, weak and wavering in the land of the Philistines, and yet God's powerful hand is all over this story, giving him safe refuge in the most unlikely of places, giving to him a city where his troops and their families can settle and find some respite, giving to him the territories of the kingdom that have been long been sitting idle, or building the kingdom through him, or giving him an out when he's faced with this impossible predicament. In other words, here's the point, a simple point from the text today. Basically, what you see in this text is what we've been seeing all throughout the wilderness. That God's hand is unrelenting in working for the good of his servants, his people. His hand has been unrelenting in keeping and holding steadfast his servants according to his purpose. His hand has been unrelenting in providing safety and security and protection in the wilderness. His hand has been unrelenting in bringing to his servants the very things that they need all along the way. His hand has been unrelenting even in working through his servants in the wilderness. And so here we have David, you know, again, when things seem murky and dark and perhaps even lost, yet God's hand is unrelenting in working in and for David. And see, the thing is, according to the Bible, that's a promise that we can claim as well, too. If you're part of the family of Christ, if you have, well, first of all, recognized your own fallenness, your own sinfulness, your own tendency to reject the living God, your own Creator, and yet you throw yourself at his mercy and you accept the free grace that he has given to you in his Son, if you have entrusted your life to him in that way, then this promise is for you as well. You would claim what the Apostle Paul says, that truly all things work out, we know this, Romans 8, all things work out for good for those who love God. And of course that doesn't mean that all of our, you know, little struggles and hardships all just go away the moment we entrust our lives. No, Paul's saying, look, even in this present suffering, in the present difficult circumstances, I know this, all things will work out for good. In other words, your suffering is not meaningless or pointless. There is the providential hand of God, the purpose of God at work, yet behind this hardship and this suffering. Or that your suffering is not eternal. That the providential hand of God will work tirelessly until the day comes when the suffering will give way to eternal joy, to eternal resurrection life to the full. Right? This doctrine of God's providence and his providential hand has long been a great source of comfort for the church, for the saints, all throughout the ages. It shows up in the creeds and confessions of the church, shows up in the great old hymns of the church. I thought I'd just quote one for you. This is one we don't sing very often around here, or in too many churches these days anymore, but this hymn, God moves in mysterious waves, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in his dark and hidden minds, with never failing skill, he fashions all his bright designs and works his sovereign will. So fearful saints, new courage take. The clouds that you now dread are big with mercy and will break and blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. For behind a frowning providence, just think about these words, behind a frowning, what appears a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. It's a great promise to claim. Okay, but just before we close, I want to just push this even one step further. There's actually one of the really neat thing in this passage, well, or a neat little connection in this passage. Three times, Achish declares the innocence of David. And you know, in the biblical storyline, there's another time where God's true anointed king stands before a local ruler, and three times that ruler declares his innocence. But the rest of the crowd say, yeah, no thanks, get rid of this guy. It's in the court of Pilate. You go to John 19 or Luke 22, and you'll see three times. Pilate, you know, they bring Jesus before Pilate, and Pilate looks him over, asks him some questions, say, guys, I find no fault in this guy. And they say, no, trust me, we wouldn't have brought him to you if he didn't have fault. You got to crucify this guy. And so Pilate takes Jesus back, and they interrogate him. They send him to Herod, who interrogates him. Herod sends him back, says, I don't know what the deal is. And so Pilate again comes back out to the people and say, look, Herod and I, we find no fault, no guilt in this man. And the crowd say, no, crucify him. And one last time, before Pilate washes his hands of it, he says, I want you to know, I find no guilt. I find nothing in this man worthy of condemnation to death. And the people cry out, crucify him. And he hands them over. And the thing is, just like Achish, if Pilate had really known who Jesus was and really known what Jesus was all about and what Jesus was after, I don't know if Pilate would have been so quick to three times declare his innocence. Or maybe, I wonder if Pilate would have said, yeah, okay, it might be safest to get rid of this guy. Because here's the thing, right? Jesus was not content in any way to just be a nice local teacher, prophet. He was not content in any way to just be a nice little local ruler, a nice little local leader there in Jerusalem. Or he wasn't even content to be ruler or king over Israel. Do you understand? This Jesus, in his own words, was coming to unleash the full program at long last of reclaiming and restoring God's creation, of coming and claiming all the kingdoms of the earth. This Jesus was coming after what he would later say to his disciples, all power and all authority in heaven and on earth. And see, the biblical and then the New Testament message is that in the resurrection of Jesus, that whole taking over part is underway. The enemies of God have thrown everything at Jesus. They've thrown their works. They've thrown all that they could have at Jesus, and he has conquered victoriously in his resurrection from the dead. And he's been, and then now in his ascension, thank you, Bill, for sending the good, encouraging Ascension Day note this past Thursday. But in his ascension at the right hand as King with the Father, truly now, all of his enemies are being put under feet, one by one, in time, in God's own way. And so for the New Testament writers, now on the heels of that, there is this all the more deeper confidence that yes, this powerful hand of God will not stop until all the enemies have been put under Christ and all of creation has been reclaimed and all of life has been restored. And see, then here's the point I'm aiming at too. But do you understand too that in his willingness to suffer death, in his willingness to face that crucifixion, in love for you, in love for us who had long since rejected him, in love for the people that were shouting crucify him there in the crowds and were spitting on him as he's hanging in his torment, in his willingness, in love to suffer that, do you see now that not even your sinfulness will get in the way of your full inheritance, or will get in your way of that promise that's made to you that all things will work out for good and for your salvation? Right, because Christ was willing to have all of your sinfulness placed on him. And because Christ was willing that all of his perfect righteousness and unwavering faithfulness would be credited to you and placed on you as this royal garment. Now, nothing, including your own weakness and wavering, your own at times of making sketchy decisions, maybe even your own times of aligning yourself with the enemy, nothing can get in the way of God's purposes for you, both in the future and in right now. And see, this is the really encouraging part for me. Because, man, as somebody who is aware, painfully aware, probably needs to be more aware of my own weakness, my own wavering, my own times of stupid decisions and stupid failures, I'm one who knows that Satan loves to get in there and loves to you know, just sort of whisper in the mind, yeah, okay, fine, you might be saved, you might be joined to Christ, and you got good things coming, yeah, okay, whatever, but don't make ever make the mistake of thinking that God has any intention of using you, a wretched habitual sinner, for his kingdom purposes. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking that God is empowering you to use you for his kingdom glory, you know, whatever intentions he might have for you. And see, here's the thing. That's such a dangerous lie from the pits of hell. Not because I crave success or accomplishment or whatever, but because that will stop me dead in my tracks and really slow me down, right? Any one of us, we know. Man, when Satan gets our ear in that way, bends our ear, and convinces us of our unworthiness of God's grace or whatever, or just keeps replaying our sins before us, man, that will stop us dead in our tracks and will keep us from serving, from using our gifts or whatever in ministry to our family, our church, our neighborhood, or whatever. And the thing is, not only is that theologically untrue, it's just not good. Look, today's Pentecost Sunday. And Pentecost Sunday is the day where we celebrate the giving of the Spirit. But what does the Spirit do? The Spirit commissions the church for mission and kingdom-building activity. Right? Jesus tells his disciples after his resurrection, go back into the city until you get that power from on high. And then off we go, and we're off and running. Right? So today is the day not to wallow in our weakness and our wavering and our failures, but to see the beauty of Christ poured out and clothing us, and recognize that even our own sinfulness doesn't inhibit God from accomplishing his purposes for us and accomplishing his purposes in us. See, that's the beauty of this passage. Here's David, weak and wavering, hiding out in Philistine territory, engaged in all sorts of sketchy activity, maybe, and yet God is using him in perhaps the most powerful ways we've seen yet to accomplish his kingdom purposes. And in Christ, that's the promise for you too. So if you're here today and you are, you know, weighed down with guilt, or you've allowed that voice to linger, man, don't let it slow you down. Don't let it stop you. See Christ. Get up and get back at work. I was thinking about this week. Or just this morning, actually. I was thinking about yesterday. We were playing Ultimate Frisbee, some of the high school guys, you know, young adults, and where's Josiah Kessler? He's back there. Yeah, there you are. He was on the other team. He was kind of annoying to me. Because the guy's so fast, and he runs all over the place. And the other team would chuck the frisbee down the field, and maybe it would be a bad throw and totally miss the target and just fly over the head. But for some odd reason, Josiah was always there to pick it up. Half the times he'd be there picking it up in the end zone or whatever you call it, and he'd score a point for him. I was like, oh, good gracious. Or for our team, we had Jacob Bronkema. He's home from college. You know, he's a foot taller than everybody else. He's got that youthful speed about him. So worst case scenario, if I couldn't figure out anybody else to throw the frisbee to, I would just, you know, nod to him and just, you know, send a frisbee way down into the end, knowing that, hey, this could be a terrible pass. But because Jacob's fast and taller than everybody, he'll go down there and clean up my mess and just score a point for us. You know, in the same way, there's something of that picture going on here. You see that the kingdom is God's to build. He's going to build it in spite of us through no fault of our own. And you see that in the death and resurrection of Christ, right? Nothing, even our own sin doesn't prohibit us from engagement. And see, we can get engaged even in our weakness, even in our times of doubt, even in our times of struggle. And in a sense, we serve and we throw up these Hail Marys, and God can take and use it, whatever weak offerings we give, and use it in great ways for his kingdom. Weak analogy, perhaps, but you get the idea. So what do you have in this story? Two things. In even dark times, hopeless times, God's hand is still relentlessly at work. And then the second thing is, even despite our weakness, our wavering, our times of unfaithfulness, our times of failure, yet God, through the mercies of Christ, the love of Christ, and the empowerment of his Spirit, can work incredible things with us and through us. And so we take courage and get back at it and commit ourselves to faithfulness on his behalf. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.